Hi, I'm Tara Byrne. I'm an associate solicitor in the medical negligence team at Boies Turner. Today I'm talking with my colleagues Martin Anderson, associate solicitor in the personal injury and asbestos disease team, and Claire Rowntree, partner in the personal injury team.
Hello, Tara.
Hi, Tara.
So we're here today to talk about the work we do with families who have lost a loved one. These are often referred to as fatal accident claims. So our clients come to us at the most difficult of times. Martin, Claire and I work in slightly different areas, so we see different situations with our clients. So I work in our medical negligence department. My clients have lost loved ones as a result of substandard medical treatment. So this can be to do with incorrect or late diagnosis of conditions or management of those conditions and surgical errors. So we have to look at whether the treatment someone received fell below a reasonable standard and whether that contributed to the death. What are the circumstances that you see your clients come into in, Martin?
So families will often come to me following the death of one of their loved ones due to an asbestos-related disease, which is, of course, absolutely devastating for them. And there's always huge amounts of emotional distress in these types of cases. On top of that, they often have very serious financial concerns, which add to what is a very stressful situation anyway. There are an increasing number of cases of asbestos-related cancers in women. I think it's important not to downplay that. However, it's fair to say that the vast majority of the cases I see involve men that were exposed to asbestos at work. And most of them tend to be of a generation where it was quite common for their wife to stay at home and bring up the children while they went out to work, which means that quite often in these cases, the husband will have had a much bigger pension than their wife, and they'll have been financially dependent upon that. So where the husband tragically passes away due to an asbestos-related illness, and that pension income can stop overnight, that causes a lot of worry and stress upon their death, which is very difficult. I'm sure, Claire, when in personal injury cases, the demographic of your clients, I'm sure, is a lot more varied. But I expect families probably have similar concerns in a lot of the cases that you come across as well.
That's right, yes. Most of the cases that we deal with are on behalf of families who've lost a loved one in a road traffic accident. For example, pedestrians who've been run over, collisions caused by speeding or drunk drivers, or vehicles that have veered out of their lane, head-on collisions or hitting people on lay-bys, that sort of thing. We also represent families who've lost a loved one in the workplace. For example, we acted for a family of a man who had worked for a haulage company and he was hit by a reversing truck in the yard. We've also dealt with a number of public liability claims. So, for example, victims of the Paddington and Ufton Nervet train crashes.
And often the initial stages involve gathering information, documentation to look at the circumstances surrounding the deaths. What sort of things do you ask your clients for at the outset?
So at the outset, the key question for us really will be whether or not we can find a witness that can give detail as to how the exposure to asbestos happened. So sometimes the family might know someone that the deceased used to work with who can give us that information. Sometimes we may have pursued the same employer before in the past, and we'll have taken statements from people who did similar jobs and were exposed in the same way. And in some cases, we'll do a witness appeal in a local newspaper and appeal to people that used to work at the same employer to come forward and give information to us, which can often yield a positive response for us, especially if it was a big local employer in that area.
And same for personal injury claims as well. I mean, we rely heavily on witnesses, but it also depends on the type of claim that we're investigating. So, for example, in fatal road traffic accidents, police reports and information gathered by the police is going to be really vital to us, such as vehicle inspection reports, forensic collision investigator reports, any dash cam or CCTV footage, tachographs, that sort of information. In workplace accidents, there may be HSE documents and reports. The employer should be carrying out their own accident investigation and again will be relying on witnesses. And in public liability cases, it will really depend on the circumstances of the accident, but there may be documents arising out of a public inquiry.
And Claire, we've spoken before about how in certain circumstances an inquest will take place after a person's death, sometimes referred to as a sort of a fact-finding inquiry to work out the circumstances of what's happened to lead to that death. Claire, could you perhaps tell us a bit more about your experience helping families in that situation?
Yeah, we have represented a number of families actually, Tara, at inquest, and we use that as an opportunity to gather important information and evidence where a defendant insurer has not admitted fault at that stage and potentially won't admit fault until the conclusion of an inquest. It's important for families to know, though, that the inquest is not about proving fault or liability. And it's for the coroner to ask really four main questions about a person's death: who the person was, when they died, where they died, and how someone has died. There are limited conclusions that the coroner can reach about the death, and the coroner is not generally concerned about showing that the death has been caused due to someone's fault or negligence. And at the end of the inquest, the coroner can provide their conclusion in short form, or they can provide a narrative or a combination of both. And sometimes the conclusion can be open if the coroner can't reach a conclusion about what has happened. But as you say, Tara, sometimes in those proceedings, experts and witnesses will be giving evidence. And sometimes that can be really, really helpful and useful information in helping you with a claim on behalf of families who've lost a loved one.
Yeah, I would certainly echo that, Claire, from sort of my perspective as a medical negligence solicitor. It's, although it's rare to sort of get a conclusion of negligence or neglect, the information that we can gather through the inquest process, witness statements and expert evidence can sometimes help us to work out what the basis of a claim might be. Martin, you mentioned earlier about how the sudden loss of a family member can result in the financial strains and difficulties on a family. So one of the things all three of us have to look at is how we work out the level of compensation that a claim might achieve. And this is set out by two laws, so the Fatal Accidents Act and the Law Reform Act. I'm just going to touch on these briefly, but the Law Reform Act deals with claims on behalf of the estate. So that could cover funeral expenses, any pain or suffering that the person who's died experienced before their death, and also any financial losses they might have incurred. The Fatal Accident Act allows claims to be brought on behalf of what's known as a dependent. And there's a list in the Act as to who is actually a dependent. I'm not going to go through them all as they are quite extensive, but it can be a wife or a husband, as well as a former wife or a husband, civil partners, unmarried couples who had been living together for the last 2 years, and also parents and children. And a dependent is able to bring a claim in respect of financial dependency. So if they were reliant on, as Martin mentioned earlier, pension income, for example, but also loss of services. So if that person sort of did activities like household chores, gardening, DIY, that sort of thing. And Martin, I think you're just going to talk about the financial dependency claims in a little bit more detail.
Yeah, so I mentioned about how I see a lot of cases where the widow will have been dependent on their husband's pension. Where that's the case, it's fairly straightforward to work out what their dependency was. But I do see more and more cases now where the deceased was still working at the time they got an asbestos disease. And sometimes they're self-employed, or they might have a business which is growing. And it's then very hard to say what their income would have been in the future, which makes it very difficult to assess what the level of dependency would have been. So in those cases, we'll quite often get a report from a forensic accountant, which I think you sometimes do in clinical negligence cases. Is that right, Tara?
Yes, we do. Yeah. So sometimes if there's a significant loss of earnings or loss of pension claim, as you mentioned, then yeah, we would look at getting a forensic accountant to help us. And also if there's a potentially promotions in the future, just a way to project that forward, an accountant can help us with that. And I've also had cases where dependency was on state benefits. And recently, one of my clients was financially dependent on her daughter who had died, which was a bit of a less common situation. And we also have to look at any loss of services claim. So what sort of issues have you had around that on your cases?
So that's often a big thing in asbestos disease cases, because the deceased will quite often have been a skilled tradesman in the past. And they are, I can say from personal experience, they are very useful people to have in your family. I'm fairly terrible at DIY myself, but my father-in-law used to be a carpenter, and he's basically the family handyman, which is often the case with a lot of these people as well. So if they're not around anymore, families might pay someone to come in, do work for them when things go wrong in the house, which they wouldn't have had to do before. So that's an example of what we call a loss of services claim. And it's something else that's very important in these type of cases. And we'll often find that care is something we need to consider as well, because with these illnesses, it can be very difficult towards the end of their life, and they often need a lot of care from family members and also from professional carers. Where that care has been sort of very extensive, we might get a report from a care expert that details all the care that was needed. I'm sure you must do that quite often in clinical negligence cases as well. Is that right, Tara?
Yeah, exactly. So we sort of do it in two ways. So not only about the care towards the end of someone's life, but also if someone who has died was providing care for someone else. So quite recently, we had a case where our client's wife had passed away, and she was the primary care provider for their two children, one of whom had cerebral palsy. So we needed a bit of guidance from a care expert in that situation to help us with costing up the cost of replacing the care that our client's wife would have provided their children. And as that case had two children involved, we had to make sure that the settlement was approved by a judge. And Claire, I think you have experience with what known as approval hearings.
That's right, Tara. In many of the cases that we act for families who've lost a loved one, they will often be the main provider of childcare. And so we will have to seek an overall approval from the court of the settlement, and then ask the judge to decide on the appropriate apportionment of the settlement sum for the benefit of the child or children. And this money is then held in the court or in a trust fund for the child or children until they reach 18.
One thing we've not discussed yet is the bereavement award, which is a fixed sum of just over £15,000. There are strict eligibility requirements for this award, and they've been a point of discussion for some years, Claire.
That's right. There's been a lot of controversy over bereavement awards over many years, in fact. APIL, that's the Association of Personal Injury Lawyers, pressed the government for change to enable all cohabitees to be eligible to claim the statutory bereavement award. Currently, bereavement damages can be claimed by the husband, wife, civil partner, parents of the deceased child when the deceased was under the age of 18. So there were some government reforms in 2020 under the Fatal Accidents Act, and this extended the scope for eligible claimants, but it only extended to unmarried cohabitees who were living in the same household as the deceased immediately before the date of death, and had lived together for at least 2 years before the death. So whilst the reforms are an improvement, they just don't go far enough. For example, a child cannot claim for the death of a parent. So the Association of Personal Injury Lawyers are continuing to campaign for the right of victims. And in July 21, the Justice Minister advised the government did not currently have any plans for wider consultation on the bereavement damages regime. So we'll have to see what happens there.
Well, thanks, Claire, and thanks, Martin, for joining me today. It's a tragic topic, but it's always interesting to learn and talk to each other about the different types of work that we do.
Absolutely. Cases are so sad. Claiming compensation is never going to make up for what these families have gone through, but hopefully we can make life a little bit easier for them at such a difficult time.
And I think the take-home message is that no amount of compensation is going to bring that person back. It's about trying as best you can, based upon expert evidence, to quantify what the financial loss is as a result of losing that person. And as I say, no amount of compensation is going to bring that person back. So these are really difficult cases.
If you or your family member have experienced the death of a loved one and have questions about a medical negligence or personal injury case, please do not hesitate to contact our team at Boies Turner so we can talk about what your options are. You can find our details on our website, boiesturnerclaims.com. If you'd like to hear more from our team at Boies Turner, please subscribe or follow our podcast. Thanks for listening. Bye.